It's Something for Nothing, the Rush Fan Cast, Jerry and Steve with you. Jerry, we could still do this.
Let's hope so. I'm not sure if we can. A little rusty.
We're back.
If only for a few episodes.
If only for a few episodes. I guess we should talk about why we're back.
Yeah, that's a good question, Steve. Why are we back?
Well, the number one reason is we left a really, really good guest on the table when we left.
That's true, we did.
And it never really sat well with me that we never got to this guest.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess that was the thing that kicked this whole renaissance off.
And the other thing is, you know, I miss talking to you every week.
Yeah, I was going to try and pretend like we hadn't spoken to each other since January. But that's not going to work.
And I miss talking to the listeners every week. I'm sure you did too.
I did. You know, I took a really, really, really long break from emails. So in the past couple of months, I've been going through the emails. We're still getting emails, Steve. I find that hard to believe, but we are still getting emails.
And people are still listening, which we really, really appreciate.
Oh, yeah. People are still listening. I'm just amazed every month that our numbers have been maintaining themselves somehow over the past, what's it been, 10 months?
Yeah.
So thank you, everyone who listens. Some people are listening again. Can you believe that? They listen to episodes more than once.
It really is amazing. And we really thank each and every listener for sticking with us and doing that.
Yeah, I'm not even really sure we ever said anything too interesting enough to listen to twice, right?
Well, the other thing is what we're doing here is very un-Rush-like.
How so?
Well, we had a farewell tour of sorts. We had a farewell episode.
Right.
And here we are back. We're doing like Kiss. We're Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. That's what we are.
Yeah. As long as we don't start selling the Something for Nothing coffins, I think we're okay.
Hey, there's an idea.
Themed mortuary wear.
And the other reason is we love talking about Rush, and we haven't talked Rush enough in the past, 9 months?
That's true. That's true. We have been to a few concerts, though.
True.
Which has been fun. But yeah, no Rush talk, really.
You can find us on X, Jerry, at Rush Fancast. I haven't said that before. Instagram, you can find us at The Rushcast. You can also find us on Threads, Jerry. There's something new for you.
Threads, that's right. I was way into Threads for about 3 weeks.
And as always, the email is therushcast@gmail.com. Jerry loves getting your emails still.
I do, even though I might not check the email for a couple of months at a time at this point.
But now that we've done a new episode, I think you have to check it more frequently.
Yeah, I'm going to have to send out an email or two.
There you go. And we are still available on Podbean, Jer, and all your favorite podcast apps. And of course, the bass intro and outro, he hasn't gone anywhere.
No, he hasn't.
No, Lex is still with us.
He's a diehard.
He's a diehard.
He's ride or die.
He's ride or die. And what else is ride or die is the email. Let's hear it.
All right. Well, this is from Paul from Seattle.
What's up, Paul?
He sent this in June.
Okay.
So it was, 6 months after we stopped.
Okay.
He said, I'm listening to the final episode right now. Funny, I paused it when it first hit my queue a couple of months ago after hearing the intro and not wanting to hear the way the book ends when I had only discovered the podcast earlier this year and have so many episodes yet to hear. But some random thoughts. We are about the same age, I think. I turn 55 in a few weeks. So his birthday must have been in June or July. So happy birthday, Paul.
Happy birthday, Paul.
I went to a Rush show when Signals came to Phoenix Memorial Coliseum. My best friend got to meet Neil that evening. Long story that passes through Howard Ungerleiter and my high school freshman English teacher.
Wow.
I don't know what the connection is between them. I also saw them for Grace Under Pressure. I own one of the three prototypes of Alex's white ES-355 that Gibson made when they were designing the copy of his original. Yeah, the one that went at auction for north of $300,000 last year.
Wow.
I happen to know that Alex got one of the other prototypes, so I don't think he gave up the guitar entirely. I also have one of the Lifeson Les Paul models that were released around the time of Snakes and Arrows. The serial number on the back of the headstock is hand-sharpied by Alex. One of 50 each, of two colors at the time. I have some drumsticks that Lorne played on one of Neil's kits that made its way to Sweetwater Sound in 2019. I have been breathing Rush air since I was around 14. Finally got to shake hands and got the photo with Alex and Getty a few years back. My wife and I attended RushCon once and only once in Toronto, and lo and behold, my mug makes an appearance for a split second in the extras on Beyond the Lighted Stage.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
This guy is plugged in. Anyway, Rush has been in my life since around 1982, and I've always considered myself in the top 10% of Rush fans, considering things like which guitars I own and who my favorite guitarist is and how many new rabid Rush fans I've made. But I didn't do a podcast, and for that, I'm a little embarrassed. I could have and should have, but you guys did, so major kudos to you for all the work you've put into the Rush universe. The only reason I was prompted to email was that I have a long way to go to hear all of your episodes and was a little concerned about how long they might be kept online. I have been very fortunate in life and can afford to support various enterprises here and there. If you guys are taking donations, let me know how much I should donate to cover the cost of podcast hosting for, say, 10 years. Shouldn't take me nearly that long, but then again, I've got teenagers in the house that are not fully rabid fans yet, so I need it to stay up even longer. Ideally, 1,000 years or more should be the goal. It's all timeless.
Wow.
So he wants to fund the podcast for 1,000 years. And I did the calculation. That's a little bit over $180,000 if he wants to contribute somehow.
Well, he offered 10. I think that's probably fine, don't you think?
Yeah, we're not taking donations, obviously. But still, it's a very generous offer, Paul.
Well, here's the thing, though. When we die, if Paul's younger, well, he's 55, right? If we die before he does, maybe he should take over the payments.
Yeah. I don't really think that in 1,000 years anyone's going to be listening to, you know, podcasts. Who knows what'll happen?
You never know. You never know. The other question I have is, Jerry, do you consider yourself in the top 10% of Rush fans like Paul does?
I don't know. We've met some pretty hardcore Rush fans, so I'm not sure where I would be. Maybe top 20.
I'm going to say we're definitely less than the top 20% of Rush fans, even though we did a Rush podcast.
Yeah, it's hard. That top 10% would be hard. We're talking worldwide, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So before we get to our guest, Jer, who, as I mentioned, is an incredible guest, we should talk about what we've been up to for the past 9 months.
Yeah, not much. So there you go.
Well, one thing we did we should talk about, right? We took part in the Neil Peart Memorial Golf Tournament in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario.
Oh, yeah, that was lots of fun. It was a beautiful
day.
It
was beautiful. Nancy Peart was nice enough to invite us, and we got to meet today's guest at the tournament.
That's right.
Little spoiler alert. And our team was Mark Irwin and Ray Wozniak, who've been on this podcast numerous times.
That's right. And I think between the four of us, we might have lost about 45 golf balls.
Right. By the end of the tournament, we each had one ball left.
Right. And we just had to hope that at the last hole, we didn't lose our last ball.
If there was one more hole, we were in trouble.
That's true. We were.
And the other thing we did was we attended Rush Day at Henderson Brewing just a few days prior to that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was a lot of fun, too.
That was. We got to meet Steve Himmel. He was our guest on episode 115 of this podcast.
Yep, true.
And there was an amazing amount of Rush memorabilia there, which I was blown away by.
Yeah, I think my favorite thing was the rotisserie chicken holders.
Oh, yeah. That was great.
Those were there. That was pretty cool.
My favorite thing was the rug. Was it from the R40 tour? The rug that was on the stage for the R40 tour?
Yes. It was enormous.
And what Steve Himmel told me, which I found incredible, is that the first time that rug was unrolled since that tour was to display it in the brewery.
What?
And the tape that was on the rug, I don't know if you noticed, there was yellow tape on the rug.
Yeah.
That was the same tape that was on the rug when it was on the stage for the tour. So I guess Getty and Alex knew where to stand for certain songs and stuff.
Huh.
Incredible.
That's cool. Yeah, I don't remember you telling me that. Did you tell me that and I just forgot?
I did tell you that. You must have had too much beer at the brewery.
Right. You know me.
And the other big news since we've been gone is Getty's new book is coming out.
That's true. We're going to see him as well.
Yep. We're going to go see him on November 13th, and we're going to get the book that day, and it's going to be released the next day. So we're going to get it the day before it's released. How cool is that?
Wow, the day before. How cool is that? I didn't know that. I mean, I knew we were getting the book. I just feel bad for whoever has to lug a few thousand hard copy books to every one of those shows that he's doing, because everybody who buys a ticket gets a book. We're seeing him at the Beacon Theater, if I'm not mistaken, which is a few thousand people.
Yeah.
That's a lot of hardcover books.
And the whole Rush Fancast crew is going to be there. Me, you, and Lex.
The whole crew. All three of us.
So look for us. We're going to be wearing the Rush t-shirts. We'll be those three guys.
Yeah.
So if you see us.
We'll be the ones in the Rush t-shirt. That's going to narrow it down.
But the strange thing is, at the brewery, speaking of the brewery, a bunch of our listeners recognized us, which I was floored by.
I know. So was I.
How do you recognize people who do a podcast?
I think a couple of times we've posted pictures of ourselves. Just a couple of times.
Yeah, but there's no video component to this. So, I mean, I could see if people were watching the videos, them recognizing us. But just off a few pictures randomly, I would never in a million years recognize a host of a podcast that I listen to.
Some people have great memories for faces. I'm not one of those people, but
it was nice to meet our listeners at Henderson Brewery. You know who you are. And as I mentioned, Jer, we met today's guest at the Neil Peart Memorial Golf Tournament, but this interview was recorded prior to that date. He's a poet from Port Dalhousie, Ontario, and now resides in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's also the younger brother of Neil Peart, Danny Peart. Welcome to the Rush Fancast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Danny, we usually ask our guests their Rush origin story, and I'm guessing yours is very unique. When did you first hear Rush, and how did you become a fan?
Let me give you two small stories. The first is, you know that we had a farm equipment dealership, International Harvester in St. Catharines, Ontario, with my father. And Neil and I were working there. I was 18 years old. Neil was 20. He had gone already to audition with the guys from Rush in Toronto, and that story is probably well known. So what happened then is they decided to offer Neil the position as drummer with that band. So they arrived at the dealership in a white Corvette, and I was there. And they brought the first album that they'd done without Neil and gave that to him and gave him an offer to come out on tour with Alex and Getty. So he was our parts manager at the time, which is a really important role. It was summertime, and he had to go and speak to my dad, who would then speak to my mother, and everybody gave him our blessing to go to Toronto and join that band. So that was the first time I would hear about Rush. And then we would kind of just get along without Neil at the farm equipment dealership. And then that was 1974. I also left St. Catharines that fall to go to university in Kingston, Ontario. And then I would see that band for the first time. The first time would be at a high school dance in 1974 in Kingston, Ontario. And it's very much like the end of the R40 tour plan, where you had these three guys on a stage in a high school. You had maybe 24 people milling around watching because they could not dance to these guys. Right. But you could see close up, you're only 20 feet away from those three. You could see the talent in the way these three played their instruments. And Neil always did a solo right through his teenage years with every band, every concert. And he would do a solo there too. So that was just filling in gigs while they went on tour for some. They sometimes could tour 300 days in a year. And so that was high school. That was kind of entertaining that you're right there with them, with few people in a high school. And then the next night they played at our university in Grant Hall, probably opening for Nazareth. That's quite easy to check. And then I would see them on a larger stage as the opening act. And there began my relationship with watching those three guys from Rush.
Now, how did Neil feel about his audition? Did he have a good feeling about it?
He really felt that there was potential here when he would receive that album that they'd already made. And it was his chance. He went to Toronto, where they would rehearse for a little while and then go on tour. But the first thing they did when he arrived in Toronto was they took him to a really good music store, and they told Neil he could choose any instruments for percussion that he wanted to go on tour. This is sort of a, this is a 20-year-old drummer. This is sort of a dream, right? Right. Like any drummer, he'd worked out from 13 years old to put his kits together. And now he was, you know, brought into that store, and they said, pick anything you like, and we'll buy it. We're going on tour.
Now, is that when he bought Chromie? Is that the kit he bought on that day?
I don't know. The real percussion fans would be able to go through those kits. but that was the kit he would go out with. Any pictures you see in probably 1974 to 1976, Neil would be on that drum kit, just bought off the floor in a Toronto music shop.
Wow, that's incredible.
And then I don't think when you read the history, I don't think they had a lot of time to rehearse before they went to the United States and went on tour.
Yeah, I think I had read, at least in one place, it was about 2 or 3 weeks that they had.
Right. And again, at that time, imagine when Neil is learning the songs that they're going to be an opening act, so that limits how many songs. And then they only had written so many songs.
Right.
But you'll remember that had Working Man, that had In the Mood, that had some songs that have really lasted.
Oh, yeah. Still playing its tours 30 years later.
Yeah.
40 years later.
And then their productivity, once Neil joined those two, and they came out with Fly By Night, that would be the first time Neil in the lyric position and in the drum creation position. So they came out with that album, Fly By Night, that did very well. And I'm sure you know that's when Neil started working with Hugh Syme. Mm-hmm. But then you watch those guys, and they worked so hard for the next 10 years. It was very hard to keep up with them. The albums they were making, where they were playing, their work ethic for the next 10 years was really extraordinary.
Now, what did you and your family think, Danny, as Rush slowly began to rise to stardom? From 1974 to 1980, the trajectory was straight up. What were your thoughts?
Well, he became a rock star fairly quickly. I remember I had an early marriage in St. Catharines in 1977, and Neil was going to be an usher with 200 people at a young wedding. And he realized that it was the wrong role for him. First of all, imagine Neil Peart as an usher in a traditional wedding at that time, 22 years old.
With a big handlebar mustache.
Yes, and in a tuxedo and with the wedding party. And then he also didn't want to be the star attraction at his brother's wedding. And then you do the whole dinner, open bar, dancing, photos, all of those things. And then the DJ was instructed, do not play Rush music at my wedding. Right. Well, we're about an hour and a half into the evening, and don't I hear Fly By Night at my wedding? And that's a surprise to me. I was very clear about this. So I walked over to talk to the DJ, and he's surrounded by a dozen people. And he sees me. He says, I am so sorry, but they would not leave me alone, Danny, until I played that song. So shortly after that, I would have to walk him out to the parking lot and let him leave, because he's not comfortable in these social situations.
Right.
It's not where Neil wants to be.
Now, was Neil comfortable with his new role as lyricist for the band? Did it take some cajoling for him to take that role on?
I don't think so. He has, a grade 10 education, but he is so smart and so hardworking and so well-read that I think he took to this role very quickly. Even if you look at his earliest songs, they are so good. When you look at that Rush Fly By Night, if you guys ever had the album version that came out in 1976, you look at his lyrics, you know what I mean? When they're handwritten.
Yeah.
This guy was extraordinary as a young person. And you knew before he started with Rush, he was already reading voraciously. This fellow really was determined to communicate well. And if he's going to be writing lyrics that'll become songs, you know he's going to try to do it very well. He wrote Fly By Night. When you listen to the themes there in the story, he wrote that on the airplane on the way to London to try to make it as a musician there. He was 18, but that's where he would write that song. And you can hear that in the lyrics. That's his story.
Now, you were only 2 years younger than Neil Danny. So what sort of a role model was Neil for you? I mean, it must have been amazing to have an older brother have such success, and you must have looked up to him so much.
Yes, no question about that. It was always fun. We were always completely different. When you read about Neil's teenage years and how rebellious he was and the way he dressed and how he was totally crazy for rock music and Keith Moon and The Who and Cream and all of these bands I had no awareness of. Meanwhile, I was the athletic person. You might find me in a high school musical. If you asked me to be any sports team I would play, I was the guy that Neil makes fun of. I was the jock who played lacrosse, hockey, football, basketball, any game I would play. And then I was going to go to university, and I wanted to teach English and phys ed. So I loved that he was being a working musician. He was writing me letters at the time from wherever he was. That was really a lot of fun, writing letters to each other. Neil and I think, would rather write letters to each other than talk in person. You know, it's as if this is the way we were supposed to communicate, that we could be clearer if you gave us something to write than if we had to speak to each other at a family function. Anyways, yeah, I was completely fine with it. He did lead the way. Everything he was reading, he'd read Wallace Stegner, then he'd start me off. He'd read Jack London, start me off. Hemingway, Fitzgerald. He would read the poets way before I ever thought of writing a poem. He would send me T.S. Eliot. He'd send me Robert Frost. He would send me Pablo Neruda. He was definitely, if I was going to be a writer, he was blazing that trail very clearly for me.
Now, why do you think that is, that you had so much more comfort communicating through writing as opposed, you know, just through speaking in a family function? Is it because there's a lot more consideration that you could put into your thoughts when you're writing them down?
There's that, that we're introverted by nature and we like to communicate, and we are more comfortable writing people than in conversation or at a microphone. We are written storytellers. We want to publish printed books. We don't want to be oral storytellers, right? Anyways, it's just the way we are wired. And sometimes we don't know what we're going to write in a letter until we begin writing. We don't know where a poem would go until we engage. We enjoy that idea that you could see a scene when you're out walking or skiing or traveling. And then when you write it down, you relive it again. And then if you're very good at writing, you can share what you're seeing in the world. And you can tell when you read Neil's books, he was paying attention. You know, whether he's on a motorcycle or a bicycle or a touring musician, because he was going to write about this story, he was paying attention. And then he worked very hard by the time he started publishing books to be able to communicate well, so that if you guys bought his books and it cost you $24, you would feel that he had really worked hard to make that that book an enjoyable, educated, maybe funny, but something worthwhile, so that you would think you hadn't been ripped off. Why would a drummer be able to write anyway? You would think this guy works very hard and he may well be gifted as a writer. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
He might have some talent, but his talent, whether that's as a percussion player or as a writer, his talent comes from hard work. He's always been very clear about that.
Now, did you ever get a glimpse into his process for writing, you know, the revisions? I know that you helped edit his later books, but as a songwriter, did you ever get a glimpse into the iterations that he went through in the process of coming up with lyrics?
Not once did he ask me to assist him with lyric writing. he asked me any other type of writing. He was quite comfortable with us working on something together. But there was something about his lyric writing that it was a combination of what he and Getty and Alex were doing. He wrote for that band. You'll notice he didn't write a lot of solo work, right? It was all done with an understanding of what Alex would do and very much a tight communication between he and Getty, who had to sing his words. But I never understood songwriting. You know, it's maybe a cousin to poetry writing, but it's something what you have to do there with a chorus and what he had to do with rhyme, for instance, is very different from what I'm doing. So no, I never helped him at all as a songwriter.
Now, you never helped him as a songwriter, Danny, but did you ever collaborate with Neil at all on anything, a poem or?
Everything else, yes. You know how he'd do those really neat tour books?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That would come. Right, so I would be able to help with that when I'm visiting him. We were going to be story writers, so we would work on stories together. Once I started writing poetry, he was very helpful to me. And then I worked on Neil's books right from the very beginning when he did the self-published ones that you hear about, but you don't get to have them or see them. I was there. Then when he had The Masked Rider about cycling in Africa, you'll see I was there. And so, yes, once Neil started to go, I was called what is a first read editor. That means I get to see a manuscript first. And then I do whatever I can to be helpful with that book. And then eventually it's passed on to another editor who represents the publisher. But yes, I absolutely loved working with Neil on books. He was so quick. He was so talented. He was so driven. Once he entered a book kind of tunnel, there was no stopping him from the finish line. You could only guide, comment, ask. You could only be there and do your best work. If you're an editor or a first reader or a friend, you could not slow down that train. It was remarkable how Neil had this single-pointed attention to get something finished.
Now, when it comes to Rush's albums, are you a fan of the entire catalog? Because there are a lot of, you know, diehard Rush fans who have certain eras that they're more fond of. Where do you fall in your appreciation of Rush albums?
Certainly, I loved getting Fly By Night 1976 while I'm at university. And I used to buy all of the Rush albums myself rather than waiting that my brother might give it to me as a gift. And then after the early albums, at one point I would be on like a comp list and I would receive the CDs or the books or whatever he and they were doing. But at first I felt if you can't go out and buy your brother's album, what good are you really? So as soon as it was available at the local record store, I would go. A lot of their songs have ended up on my playlist. When we went through all the albums I would have, then I'd have all the CDs. Then I would, you know, you'd go to that buying a song for a dollar sort of to make an Apple right. playlist.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I have maybe 500 or 600 songs, but Rush is right into that because I shared my playlist originally with my two sons. And so because they had access to the Rush catalog, they're young. So they kept adding Rush to my playlist. So, and sometimes you're driving along trying to chill and relax. And then here comes Working Man or Tom Sawyer. It's like, wait a minute. So anyways, I love a lot of the 2112. I was a big fan of some of the playing there. All the Clockwork Angels phase, everything to do with that. The tour itself, the books, everything to do with Clockwork Angels. And you remember them when they went on tour with the string section?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was so amazing. Like you could tell they were having a great time having that string section behind them.
Yeah.
Right in the sound check, you could see how much fun those three were having with those musicians on tour. And it made an amazing impact, that Clockwork Angels, the way they did the design. It was like a lot of fun. And then when they came out, you must have got to the final tour, R40.
Yes.
When they came out with that way of doing a 3-hour concert in reverse, that was very entertaining. to realize how much they've accomplished. And, you know, they say how Rush could be the sort of the playlist, the song list of your lifetime. Obviously, you would feel that with my family. We were there for that 40 years. We got to go to the concerts. We actually got to go backstage and meet everybody. Eventually, I'd even get to eat with the crew. Things were really getting good for me then. My children, who are 24 and 26 now, they grew up attending Rush concerts, hearing Rush music. Eventually, they'll read Neil Peart books. Their work means a lot to me, no question.
How is it, as a music fan of musicians you don't know, being a huge fan of them, but then also being a huge fan of your brother and musicians that you do know? Do you have a special kind of attitude toward certain Rush songs that maybe other people don't have, a certain kind of insight into them that the rest of us don't have?
I don't think so, really. Now in the final years, we were able to look at the set lists, right? So we knew what we were going to be hearing that evening. And it's important to say that I would only see them once per tour. I would only see them when they're in the city where I live. So if I'm in Kingston, if I'm in Montreal, if I'm in Vancouver, I would only go to one concert per tour. That's all. And then in the last two tours, maybe I might see two of the shows. If I had friends in Edmonton or in Seattle, maybe two, but it was kind of unique that I would see them every tour, but only once. That was the way I chose to do it. We'd get to go down to some of these gorge amphitheater type concerts. Mm-hmm. And so that was a lot of fun to do a family road trip. And your goal is to see one concert and then you stay somewhere and make your way home. So that kind of a journey was a lot of fun. I only went when you'd say, why didn't you go on tour with your brother? Because he's got his own bus and all that gig. Well, once I did, he flew me down from Vancouver to San Francisco. We'd kind of cycle into maybe one concert in the Bay Area. And then he would put me up in the Four Seasons, Newport Beach, because he wanted to cycle together to where the Swallows returned to at Capilano or whatever. And so we were putting together a cycling trip. So we cycled there. But unfortunately, the Swallows were not in residence. We had not checked that closely enough. Anyways, then there was a big cast party that night for the crew in that area. I was young, and I drank a little bit more than I should have. It was open bar and dinner with Neil at the Four Seasons. And the next morning when I had to go back to Vancouver to work, I was gone. I couldn't even put my bicycle together to like bag it and go on an airplane. And his assistant at that time, Andrew McNaughton, Neil called him and said, please put my brother on the plane. So that was it for me, you guys. One time on the bus, one cast crew party, and it's like, no more. Don't bring my brother anymore, okay? It's like, for some people, it's too much to be a part of that lifestyle.
What about lyrics, Danny? Are there any particular lyrics that Neil wrote that speak to you?
Ghost of a Chance. I certainly like that. What else? There's Anthem, Tom Sawyer. I just absolutely love that song. So yeah, there's nothing that jumps to me right away. It's just because I got to receive all the albums and see them. Sometimes we would speak about Time Stand Still. That one was lovely. They'd recorded it. It's on sort of a Sonny Walkman. I'm at the cottage dock and Neil says, you know, would you like to hear our new album? And so then I would hear Time Stand Still for the first time. And I'd say that is a classic song. That's a beautiful song.
Were there any songs that Neil particularly loved that he was particularly proud of?
He would not speak about that. The reason No One Knows I Exist is because I was part of Neil's private life. We cycled together, snowshoed, skied. We were not about Rush. We did not talk about Rush. I never met the business people, managers and such that are a big part of the Rush family. I was a different part of Neil's life, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I was just his brother that visited him at the cottage or in Santa Monica, where we'd go out for dinner and we'd try not to have him recognized. So we did not talk about Rush. You can understand that was Neil. Neil didn't want to talk about work with me. I didn't want him to sign things. I didn't want Rush swag from Neil. I wanted him to relax. I wanted us just to enjoy each other's company. No, he did not talk about songs he liked. In his writing, sometimes he'll talk to you about something that's hard to play.
Right.
And you know he was like a perfectionist. And so to get him to say he had played that concert well was very rare. But you and I would think he was absolutely stunning in the way he played, right?
Yeah.
So, Danny, let's talk about another collaboration of yours. Tell us how you met Brandon Dyke, who is quite a good songwriter himself. He accompanies you on many of your poems. Tell us about that.
I made a choice in the 1970s not to be involved with the Rush people, not to admit that Neil Peart was my brother. I made a choice to try to have a private life without this awareness of Neil Peart and Rush. So I was hiding out. And then I met this one fellow named Martin Vasco Urenaga, you know, for him from Argentina.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
He was over to the house for dinner one time because he would be at the tours. And this guy's crazy about Rush and Neil. He's crazy about Paul McCartney, any rock music. So I met Martin, and he was just such a sweet guy. And even nice to our dog. We really like that a lot. Martin loved our dog. And so he comes over to dinner. And so I meet Martin, and Martin was fun. And at one point, we even visited him in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And he liked poetry, so we had that in common. Then I met Tracy McClellan, Overtime Angels. And she was very kind to me and very understanding how reluctant I was to get involved with it all. And then Brandon would probably buy a book from me and read it. And Brandon could quote my work to you better than I can. He's absolutely amazing how much he knows about Rush and their lyrics and their story. And he's actually incredible about really caring about what I write. So we started working together to do the YouTube songs where I wanted to put a poet with a guitar player. And he did that with me. I record it in Vancouver, and then it's sent to Brandon in, where would you think, North Carolina? And then at one point, he agreed to play a gig with me in Port Dalhousie, Ontario. And that went well. And anyways, he's just a guy that he cares about what I'm doing. He enjoys being with me. He's just like having your own cheerleader. Do you know what I mean? And everything I asked Brandon to do, he just says, yes, will you play this gig with me? I thought we couldn't play because of COVID. We couldn't do a gig. So I said, what if we did an audiobook about my first collection of poems? I could record 21 of them in a studio. And then you would have to record. It had to be original music on his part because of copyright protection on any type of cover song. So he had to take the 21 poems. And then he receives that recording. And if you ever heard them, he records guitar to 21 different poems. And there's very little money involved. if that audiobook did well, we would share it 50-50. But I don't think we're waiting to go out for dinner on that kind of work. It's the same as those YouTube poems. I'm so happy you found them, because one of the things I'm thinking is, they're free to people. And maybe you don't like reading a poem, but what if you add a visual? What if you add music? Maybe a person might give the poem a chance. That's what I was thinking when I was doing those.
We'd love to play a few of them for our listeners, if that's okay with you, and then we'll talk about them. How does that sound, Danny?
Sure, anything you like, especially the one for my mom.
Okay, well, you want to start with that one?
Sure.
Let's start with that one. This one's called Flowing Over the Grand River Bridge, and it's for your mom, Betty Peart.
I'm going to read a poem I wrote for my mother, and it has to go better than it did the last time I tried. She was in attendance in Port Dalhousie, Ontario, and I couldn't say even one word of this poem. My cousin Maureen stepped in and read it for me. The Grand River Bridge is the only thing I remember from the town my mom is from, Caledonia, Ontario. It's been there since 1927, beautiful, arching, and 700 feet across the Grand River. This recorded poem will now travel to South Carolina, and Brandon Dyke will add music. This time he'll be playing Penthouse Serenade by the Glenn Miller Orchestra. This was the first song my mom and dad danced to. Because of the song, my parents had boats named Serenade. There was Serenade 1, 2, 3, and 4, marking a change in the boats, not that the boats were sinking. On the same page as the poem, there's an inscription by Alice Walker, which says, "Yes, Mother, I can see you are flawed. You have not hidden it. That is your greatest gift to me." Flowing over the Grand River Bridge for Betty Peart. Those tears that once embarrassed you, let them flow. Release them freely to roll down your cheeks, stream across the floor, out the front door and through the yard, then over the Grand River Bridge to Lake Erie. On through the Welland Canal to Lake Ontario. Let your tears heal the hurts, if that's possible. You've put your heart right out there, all in, bumped, raised, and covered. Even when the water was rising, you listened, laughed, and joked. Loved us enough to give us freedom. There is no finer gift. When our family traveled, you always tried to restrain your tears. Just let them flow, Mom. Let them flow. And happy birthday, Mom. Thank you.
I can't get over, first of all, how much you sound like Neil, Danny, when you're reading this.
I've heard that. And we shared the same voice with my father as well. And when we all worked together, people wouldn't know which one of the Peerts was answering the phone. Those days, every call was by telephone. Every customer was in person. And so our father was the star. He worked at that 6 days a week. It was his. Neil and I were working there just because we were his sons. We were not farmers. Neil was born on a farm in Hagersville, Ontario. I was a city boy from St. Catharines. So the fact that we were working with farmers every day was rather unique to us.
Now, there's one line in this poem that I love that I hope you can expound upon. Loved us enough to give us freedom. There is no finer gift. Tell us a little bit about that. What kind of freedom are you talking about? Just freedom to be yourself, right?
Yeah, so you'll meet my mother, but we were of an era where we're all out of the house by the time we're 18. My sister Judy went off to college and then began a family at a young age and came back to the St. Catharines area. Neil left the house by 18 and would never return. And he'd be all over the world and then residing either in Toronto for that time or in Los Angeles. I decided to make my home in Vancouver, which is an awful long way from our mother. And so she had to be good about that. And then I was a motorcycle rider from the time I was 16. And so she had to be hopefully supportive of that. Other mothers would not be so keen of teenage guys on motorcycles. And then you can imagine what it was like for my mother when Neil is driving a motorcycle all over the place, fairly fast and off road some of the time. And she would not try to curb us. And she did encourage Neil to have that rock music career. And basically, we were allowed that. I could go to university. No one in our family had been to university at that point. They or I had no idea what people do at university. It's not like today where they visit universities, you study universities, you choose programs, you apply. In those days, I was dropped off at university with a couple of bags of clothes and things. And then you didn't see your parents again until Christmas time, right? And we also hitchhiked. So my mother would drop me off at the Queen Elizabeth Highway in St. Catharines, and she'd be crying because I'm hitchhiking that sort of 4 hours or so from St. Catharines to Kingston to return to university. That was tough on moms, right? Now it's unheard of for people to hitchhike, but in our day, we hitchhiked everywhere, right? And my mom was a crying person. She was a worrier. But you would find when you meet her that she understood that we needed independence. We would love her more for having our own life that we could share.
Well, we can't wait to meet her. And the next piece we'd like to play, Danny, is called Not Quite So Handsome.
I look in the mirror and realize I'm just not good looking anymore. But what can I do about it? Buy a new sports car? A motorcycle? Oh yes, a motorcycle. Could try new glasses, new clothes from Harry Rosen, lose weight, gain some muscle. I suppose this gray beard is not helping. Wearing a tux could work, a desperate measure though. It helps me to know that writers are not expected to be good-looking anyway. Makes one thankful not to be an actor or a musician. Then I thought about my heart. Could a man become more attractive to others by showing more of his heart? Could his eyes tell you how much he cares? Maybe focus on listening better? There are so many ways to show love. The guy I see in the mirror seems to have aged 50 years, but that's only skin deep. Or perhaps I'll say, it is what it is, and get on with my shave.
Now, this is a subject that Neil covered quite a bit in his writings. We mentioned Time Stand Still, I Think I'm Going Bald, right? I mean, this is about getting older, right?
Yes. And there's a little bit of a barb in that, too, because I say for a writer or a poet, it's not very important to be handsome, but it is right. For an actor or a musician. I hope the friends I know who are actors or musicians understand I'm only kidding, right? there's lots of actors who are not the leading man. And so I was just like kidding there that it doesn't matter what I look like as long as I can write.
Right.
But yeah, I was trying to deal with that question of going through your, what if you peaked by 30 and then you're going through your 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you are changing. And then how do you deal with the world? How would you dress differently? Or I'm saying perhaps you can still be attractive, but not so much physically in what you wear and how you appear, but more so what your eyes say, what your smile says, how welcoming you are. Some people would even seem to want us to listen to them. Can you imagine that? That you'd be having conversations with people and they want you to pay attention, to listen. So I think that was what I was trying to say.
Yeah, my favorite line in this is, could a man become more attractive to others by showing more of his heart?
Mm-hmm.
We like to think that, I think as we get older, that, you know, our physical being isn't really as important as the things that we can do for others and the way that we can share our lives with the people that we love.
Yes, and it is that time. You know, you have friends and family who are having birthdays. If you had the ability to choose a card, write something in it, and then mail it, that's might be more meaningful than Facebook. I'm just saying, yeah, there are ways to express how much you care, how much you enjoy being involved with family and friends, that aren't just about, wow, I have a new suit. I have new shoes.
Right.
That's still pretty exciting. But yeah, I was definitely trying to say that. And sometimes for men too, there was this strong, silent type among men. And I don't know about you guys, but Neil and I and my father, we all had to go through the awkwardness of learning how to hug people because we grew up as handshaking people. And so then when We went to the hugging stage. We would try to handshake first, and then your handshake gets in the way of the hug. And then we eventually became good at it, right? Just because, like, our children, they're raised up, they hug everybody. It's just how they see, whether it's a grandparent or their friends, it's just, it's so part of their life, so natural. But for us, we were standoffish. We had a little bit of difficulty showing how much we care about people.
Danny, the final piece we'd like to play for our listeners is called Masterpiece.
I'm glad you chose that.
Masterpiece. The piano begins, then Sinatra sings. This time we almost made the pieces fit, didn't we? And you are listening to a masterpiece. Glenn Gould sits in his chair, handcrafted by his father to be 13 inches high. Keyboard then at chin level, humming as he plays the Goldberg Variations. Henry Mancini was hired to write the score for Breakfast at Tiffany's. He called Johnny Mercer to write the lyrics. Mancini wrote the melody in Audrey Hepburn's natural vocal range. She sang from the fire escape, and we hear Moon River for the first time. Neil, Getty, and Alex of Rush recorded Clockwork Angels, their 19th and final studio album in 2012. Though Neil considered this project the band's masterpiece, you could argue that it is one of their masterpieces. What will be my masterpiece? I wonder if a child can be considered. That would put Max and Nick in contention for me. Otherwise, I'll need to write a hell of a poem. Sinatra continues, this time we almost made our poem rhyme. How my father would smile at that line. The song written by a master, Jimmy Webb, in 1968. A masterpiece began as a piece of work by a craftsman for qualification as a master in their trade. When the time is right, consider, what will be your masterpiece? Thank you.
Now, Jerry and I have always said that Rush's Clockwork Angels is their masterpiece, and it seems like you agree.
It's not so much that I agree. It's that I was with Neil, and I know that that's how he felt. But Neil was very strong-minded about artistic work, about masterpieces. And it's where I even learned the word and what it means is from Neil. But I never assumed that that Clockwork Angels, for instance, is the favorite of Alex or of Getty. It's Neil. You can imagine he's writing those lyrics that are becoming a book, and then it's becoming a highly designed concert tour. This has got to be a real kick for an artist, right? To go through that type of process. And so I'm saying it's only one of their masterpieces. They have so many. The way they put their catalog together, the way they put their touring act and their humor and their video, the way they have conducted themselves with such integrity. Everybody wanted to work with this band. Everybody watched them and studied them, how they treated people, how they protected people so that no one was ever hurt in a surge. The way they thought about touring well, no matter how many people are going to be in that space, I think that is quite remarkable. And the same way, when I'm reading about them and getting letters from the studio of how they're creating the music, it was a lot of fun to hear from Neil when he's in the UK, when he's in Paris, when he's in some place in Ontario, and the three of them are sharing a home together, a studio, and they're creating these songs that we still have, and I think we always will have. So, yeah, I think I know you guys are involved with a lot of Rush fans, and I know you have these debates about best album, best song, best tour. But I think all of us can agree that what they have done is remarkable, and I don't think it's repeatable. You know what I mean? The studio time, the three guys all supporting each other like brothers, what they did and were able to do is really quite remarkable.
Yeah, a singular band.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this with many people, just the sheer number of incredible albums in a row for 40 plus years. And then to end with R40, which you mentioned earlier, might be the best, from my point of view anyway, concept for a tour, for a concert that I've ever seen in my entire life.
And so beautifully designed, everything. They showed how much they'd learned in those 40 years, and they didn't milk it as a farewell effort. Did you notice? You had rumors. I knew I would be seeing them for the last time, but they didn't do that. You know what I mean?
Yep.
They didn't act like this was a farewell tour. They just tried to put on the best celebration they could. And at one point, we all had a lot of fun when Neil was on tour. And at one point, we're in Vancouver and we can go out for dinner and we can have a dinner here at the house. And we're having a great time because he's on tour. And we were kind of getting sad of how much we're going to miss this type of life with Neil. And Neil did not want that at all. He'd say, let's celebrate. Let's have fun. Let's celebrate what we are doing and what we've done. He did not want any regrets. He didn't want any drama. He wanted to play concerts, and he wanted to finish while he could still play like Neil Peart. And he very much, when you read his writing in that last collection, the Far and Wide collection, he's explaining why this is the right time for him to stop playing concerts. And he's explaining why he wants to celebrate the drives in between and the touring life, rather than saying, what a shame it is that he won't be doing that type of whole motorcycle drumming, be with the crew type of thing anymore. He really wanted to be upbeat about this. And I think that's the best attitude anybody can have.
Speaking of celebrations, Danny, on October 22nd, 2022, Overtime Angels and the Peart family held the A Night for Neil concert in your hometown of St. Catharines. Can you tell us what it was like taking part in that? You read your poem, Masterpiece, accompanied by Brandon, and it was so moving. Tell us about that.
The reason I was there is, number one, I thought perhaps I could be helpful to Brandon's set. He's doing such an amazing job by himself on a big stage in a full arrangement, and I wondered if I could help, if we did one piece together. And then I also was very aware of how hard they'd worked through the cancellations over a 2.5 year period of scheduling it. And then regulations and COVID would not allow that concert to take place in St. Catharines. And I loved that they didn't give up. They wanted to give it this one more try. And I had a feeling if that Night for Neil didn't go, they couldn't quite rally and do it again. So I was so remarkably wanting to be helpful to them. So anyways, I get the gig and I'm going to be on the stage. So that means I get a backstage paid pass. I've got ID. I can go anywhere backstage, meet the other players. I can go out to see my family. I loved being backstage at a concert. But as I was arriving to park the car, I've got my wife, my two sons, and a friend in the car. And I show my ID to park near the arena. And they say, I'm sorry, you're not on the list. And so everyone starts laughing because this is my life. The first time I want to say I'm Neil Peart's brother, I'm going on stage tonight, the parking security says, you're not on the list. You can't come in. And I'm showing him my ID. I'm explaining what I'll be doing. And he has to call his supervisor, and the supervisor doesn't answer and doesn't know what to do with Neil Peart's brother. So he says, listen, you can park over there in the corner and we'll figure it out later. So my car is just having so much fun when it was, I'm so sorry, you're not on the list. You can't come in.
Oh, man.
And then once we got in there, we were so well taken care of, and we got to see those people being happy and appreciating that whole journey and the music. People hadn't gathered like that, you know, in an arena for a long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, it was just nice to be there But the reason I was there in person and you saw me for a moment on stage, which my mother missed, by the way, I saw her afterwards and my job's done. I can have a beer. And my mom says, when will you be going on?
Like I've already been on.
She's pretty busy, surrounded by people. And so anyways, that was nice. And then, you know, I stayed and had a gig with Brandon the next night that was a lot quieter. So I can tell you, I loved that those people didn't give up. They had a lot of obstacles to cross, but I really liked that their hearts were in the right place. And for the Peart family, we were thrilled with what they were doing.
So, Danny, we ask this question to everyone we speak to that knew Neil well. How do you think Neil will be remembered 50, 100 years from now? And how would you like him to be remembered?
The nice thing about it is that he will be remembered. He was the type of artist that was so singular and so talented and so hardworking. So he is going to be remembered as one of the top 10 live drummers ever. They'll argue about his place, but you and I will be so happy we saw Neil Peart play live. You know, we saw him solo and we've never seen anything like that before. And so he'll be remembered certainly as a rock drummer. I hope he'll be remembered as a writer. Almost all of his books are still in print. And so I think he's got a legacy there, especially with Ghost Rider. I think that is a wonderful book to give somebody that needs healing after losing somebody. I think he'll be remembered certainly by his friends. And I think, I don't know, time will tell, but I do like it. All of us, when we write, when you're a musician, all of us are trying to last. We'd like to be remembered that we did make a difference, that we showed up and gave it our best shot. And certainly Neil's, you can see the legacy since people heard that Neil had died. His legacy has been so huge. We are all overwhelmed by how much people cared.
Danny, thanks so much for joining us today on the Rush Fancast and sharing your stories with us. We really appreciate it. Thanks.
My pleasure. Take care, you guys.
So, Jer, I don't know about you, but speaking to Danny, I almost felt like I was speaking to Neil himself at times. He spoke so carefully, so thoughtfully. What did you think?
Yeah, I loved talking to him. I had been emailing him back and forth for a little while. And it was just great talking to him about his poems and about Neil and just everything.
And it was great to meet him at the golf tournament. We met him a few months after we had this conversation, and what a nice guy.
Yeah, what a great guy. Very generous, too, with his time with us. I really appreciated him.
Oh, absolutely. And after the conversation, after we stopped recording, he let us know that he liked the way we conducted the interview, and I was just amazed by that. It almost felt like we got validation from Neil himself, at least to me.
Yeah, you're always surprised when we do a good job at something, aren't you, Steve?
That's true.
But yeah, I appreciated his words after we spoke to him. That was nice.
Well, it just made me feel like if Neil had heard the podcast, he would approve of it too. That's all.
Yeah. Maybe we're, you know, not as schmucky as we
And Danny didn't want to push his books during our conversation, and we honored that by not asking him about the books. But we can mention it now. You can see all of his books on his website, DannyPeart.net, and I urge our listeners to check that out and maybe pick up a book of poetry or two.
Yeah, they're good.
They're very good.
An endorsement from me.
So, Jared, that about wraps up episode one of our return. You can find us on Twitter. We are at Rush Fancast. Call it X if you like. On Instagram, we're at The Rushcast. Email Jerry, therushcast@gmail.com. Let him know what you thought of our conversation with Danny Peart. And we've got one more thing to tackle, Jer.
What's that, Steve?
You got a quote, I hope.
I do. Can you believe I actually have it ready?
I thought I was going to stump you.
No. How could I forget? Even though I forgot almost every week for 175 weeks in a row.
All right.
This is from Ceiling Unlimited.
Oh, nice one.
The vacant smile of true insanity, dressed up in the mask of tragedy, programmed for the guts and glands of idle minds and idle hands.
Awesome. Thanks, Jer. Speak to you next week.
Yep. See ya. Thank you.